The Fan on FM at 93.7.
Welcome into the soft opening of what's going to be next week, 680 College Football Game Day. I'm Carlos Medina, who's been one of the co-hosts of this show for about the last 4 years. We previously had Brandon Adams on this program, but Brandon has gone on to graduate, okay? His eligibility is up. He moved on for what was a championship team. But let me tell you, we're going to start by knowing this. Throughout the fall, you're going to hear from our new 2 5-star freshman recruits to start with. Chris Mooneyham, you hear him on Fridays all the time calling high school football action. Chris, it's good to have you part of this fall programming, talking college football with us all fall.
Thank you. Good to be here. Hoping to bring a little insight, and I might bring some opinions.
I fully expect that. When you and I have done NFL programming, we've gotten the same, and so I'm holding you up to that kind of standard. And also, another one of those 5-star recruits, you know him from all the morning programming on 680 The Fan. You often hear when something goes terribly wrong, Nerney's the guy who either yells at the host or he yells at them. It's Sean Nerney from the Rude Awakening and the Front Row. Looking forward to having you on this fall.
Yeah, so this is what the other side of the glass looks like. It's a little intimidating, but it's nice. I'm glad to be here. It's going to be a fun season.
It is fun when you can just go, all right, let me just kind of show up and I'll have a couple of ideas and we'll make something happen from there. And for some reason, it then falls on everyone else behind the glass to make that work. So do appreciate you. We're out here at Smyrna Market Village. If you've been over here before, you know how great of a setup this is to spend an afternoon. This is our second annual Tailgates and Touchdowns, brought to you by Bud Light. This is one of the big events that we've been doing. This is now the second year of it. It was slowly growing. A couple years ago, it was, well, let's do a concert that we would do to open up the season. Now this has turned into a concert and an all-day festival. The music is going to get going at 3 o'clock, and we'll be on the air. I'm sure you'll be able to hear it when that starts. And then throughout the evening, we will have a headliner, Bubba Sparks. We will get a chance to hear that interview that he did with Chuck and Chernoff a little bit later on in the show. But right now, guys, we got to talk about it. We've got a college football season that has now gotten underway. The game over in Australia last night. Another example of why you don't bet on college football. The line was 20.5. Cal finishes off winning that game by 20 points over Hawaii. But that's the soft opening, kind of similar to the show. Everything is getting cranked up Thursday night and Saturday. Chris, let's start with you. What are the things that you're looking the most forward to that's going to be this week to kind of get college football rolling?
I think immediate parity. My big theme throughout the season, and we're going to talk about it a little bit later in the show, is going to be yet another year where we're going to have a good four-week stretch somewhere around the middle of the season, or maybe let's call it weeks 3 through 7, where we're going to have a good bit of chaos. And a lot of the – what's the statistic we talked about? The number one team in the AP poll over the last 12 years has not finished number one. I think we're going to see a lot of parity and the potential for a second-place team inside of either the ACC or the SEC makes it into the college football playoff.
And it's always very interesting when you take a look at the preseason rankings and then look at things at the end of the season, especially in the AP, especially in the coaches' poll. There's always a couple of mystery teams where you say, wow, what happened to them? It turns out that polls are based on last year, and it's right. A new team every year. That's why you have teams that, like, top 10 last year were Oregon and Auburn. They certainly didn't belong there. Nerney, as much as you follow Georgia Tech, We talk about the storylines of what's going on with that program. Unprecedented amount of injuries last year. There were so many things that went wrong. It obviously derailed a team that looked like they were pointed in the right direction. I think one of the things that people are kind of looking forward to is we're going to open up, seeing them play overseas early Saturday morning, and let's see what Justin Thomas in that offense. But then most importantly, that defense. What does it look like this year?
Yeah, you hit it exactly on the head right there. The defense, they lost – let's see, in the secondary last year, they had a very solid secondary. Jamal Golden, DJ White, Chris Milton. Those guys are all gone. Adam Gotz is maybe the only guy that really consistently showed pressure against the quarterback. He's in the NFL in Denver right now. So you got a lot of young guys coming up. They're going to fill some big shoes offensively. A lot of injuries. A lot of young guys had to play last year. A lot of young A-backs had to play. It's going to be good that they have Marcus Marshall, of course, former Bulldog, Keith Marshall's younger brother. Good that he's going to be back. Showed a lot of promise as a freshman. So there's a lot of unanswered questions, but a lot to be excited about as a Tech fan.
And I think when you start taking a look at Georgia, we're going to get a very up-close and personal look at that next Saturday in the Georgia Dome with North Carolina coming in. And it's so fascinating how we kind of feel like we know what's going to happen, that it's going to be – a two-quarterback deal because that's what we've seen at Alabama for years. Alabama does it this way, so this is what's going to happen over here at Georgia. They'll play two quarterbacks, and they'll figure it out from there. But realistically, we haven't heard enough from Kirby Smart to really know what exactly is the plan. Who is going to start? Who's going to see a majority of the snaps at quarterback? Oh, by the way, what are they going to do at backup running back? The announcement's been made. Nick Chubb is going to be back in the lineup, but we don't know about Sony Michel and that injury that he has over to his forearm. We don't know if Elijah Holyfield's going to be ready. Chris, a lot of intrigue with what's going to go on in a matchup of what essentially is two top 20 teams at the Dome next week.
I think that the kid's getting a start. I really do. I absolutely think that Eason's getting the start. You know I love to predict things.
Absolutely.
You will put it out there,
even if you go, okay, that one didn't work out, but you will put yourself on the line.
You've got to. You're going to be right. Hopefully I'm right more times than wrong, and that's part of our job. I think the kid's getting the start. I think he's getting the start from snap number one. And I think Georgia's headed for a 3 or 4 loss season, and that's okay. Because he will get that experience, what he needs. There's still a chance, I also believe, that it may only be 2 or 3 losses for Georgia. My biggest concern, initially, when going through the roster, looking at the statistics from last year, losing your top 4 tacklers, losing, what's the number? I've got it here in my notes. Five of your front 7. That's very key, obviously, inside the SEC. Here's the thing. Despite what we've said about their recruiting, Georgia is a reload program. And Kirby is working hard to have these kids ready. He's obviously a great teacher. And I got news for you. That defensive line is going to be a lot better than people think it is. Julian Rochester is going to have himself quite a season.
I'm very interested to see, based on how Alabama, the strength of what that Alabama program has been since 2008 when they really got things cranked up was the depth along the defensive line and the ability to roll out. Hey, here's 8 or 9 guys, and they're all on the same kind of level, and that keeps them in place. That is not the situation that Georgia's facing. I think when you start talking about at quarterback, Nerney, you're looking at a player in Jacob Eason where you're going to say, I know he's a 5-star, I know he's capable of a lot of things, but you also kind of want him to play by that Alabama standard of just don't put the defense in a weird situation.
I think in a perfect world, they want Grayson Lambert. They would have wanted Grayson Lambert to shown enough over last season to have him start and ease Eason in. I think perfect world, that's how it would have worked out.
It'd been ideal from that standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. But and I also think that this running back situation had a huge bearing on who they decide to start. Because if Nick Chubb wasn't going to be available for that first game, do you really want to have Jacob Eason in there without Sony Michel and without Nick Chubb? So the fact that Chubb is going to be back is huge for them having confidence in Eason. And I really think there's something, like Chris, I'm starting to lean towards them starting Eason. I think they're going to give him every opportunity to win that position this next upcoming week when he's practicing with the ones.
I think even with the running back situation, I don't disagree with you, but I think that Kirby wants a playmaker in there or the ability to make a big play. Remember, Alabama, with their quarterback situations over the last few years, Kirby had the opportunity to see Nick and the offensive coordinator, the pretty boy over there, having drop back.
I like how that's how you refer to him.
Five-step drop.
That's what they call me.
Lane the pretty boy.
I was talking about Lane, not you.
Oh, sorry.
Right, yeah.
No, Nerney is the pretty boy.
A pretty boy is what I should have said. Have the quarterback in the 3-step drop, turn to the right, fire out in the flat to a speedy wide receiver or a physical wide receiver who can push off the DB or run past him into the slot. Do the same thing on the left to a running back that you dump out there. Georgia can do that. Georgia can do that with McKenzie. They can do that with Terry Godwin. And they can do it with a couple of the bigger receivers if they ever become the players that we thought they were going to be.
And, guys, I think this is the problem that you run into with the Auburns of the world, with the Mississippi States of the world, with the Georgias of the world, is that when you're playing a highly competitive team to open up the season, that whole idea of I just need somebody to drive the bus, you can do that at Alabama because Alabama's so good at so many other different positions where you can say, okay, Coker's going to get a little bit, and Cooper Bateman, we'll give him some snaps too, and we'll kind of see how this plays out. At a certain point, when you're Auburn and you're playing Clemson at home, your quarterback's going to have to make plays. When you're Georgia and you're playing a North Carolina team that was playing for the ACC championship last year, you're going to have that quarterback who makes some plays at some point.
You're absolutely. And another big part of this is UNC, how are they going to game plan? Are they game planning to see a freshman quarterback? And if that's the case, Gene Chizik up there, who's got experience in the SEC, he's going to send the hounds at Eason each and every down. And if he doesn't, he's a moron because he should be.
But yes, absolutely.
Let me just say, before you jump in here, Chris.
Go ahead, yeah.
The thing that I keep going back to is, Gene Chizik, for as a defensive mind as he is, it's not like he's preparing for three wildly different dynamic quarterbacks. He's looking at, hey, you know what? Whether it's a pocket passer in Eason or a pocket passer in Lambert, I know what I'm getting.
You got it out before I had the chance.
Please,
absolutely. That's exactly
it.
Where
yeah.
I was going. Exactly where I was going. So that's why I wonder if Kirby's saying to himself, freshman quarterback who I don't think is going to crack under pressure but may not recognize defenses that are coming out of him in a sophisticated North Carolina scheme. Or an experienced quarterback who is not as talented, can't do as many things, and quite frankly wasn't great under pressure in certain situations last year. It may be, in some odd way, sort of even in the quarterback battle in that sense. So in my mind, I say take the lumps and put the freshman out there and let him get that. If he takes a week one beating, so be it.
For me, it comes back to the long-range view,
right,
that if at certain point your quarterback has to be capable of making plays to win games in certain places. And I've said this before, and I agree with Chuck Oliver. You know, him and I do the regional college football show, the Chuck Oliver Show, and he will consistently talk about, hey, I want to play something that's a gimme in game one because I just want my guy to get used to it, and mistakes aren't really going to hurt him. The thing for me, and the reason why I'm like, let's get Eason on the field as quickly as possible, that game against Ole Miss, that might not be a winnable ball game for you with a freshman quarterback on the road against a program that's at where it's at. But it's the idea of what it is as a sophomore and a junior. When you're looking around at the lights in Knoxville and you go, yeah, no big deal, I've already seen this sort of thing. Yeah, no big deal, conference game on the road, I've already been through this sort of thing. It's not that big a deal. And when you look at Georgia's schedule, you don't really have a lot of those opportunities on it where it's a tough road game this year.
I by the way, just got to slip this in here because you talked about down the line. Here's another prediction. Jacob Eason's going to be a four-year guy.
Okay, you're going to go with that.
After his junior year, he could probably be a first-round draft pick, but I absolutely think this kid loves the University of Georgia. He's staying 4 years. They'll be very close in his junior year. Maybe a one-loss club that plays in a big bowl game, just misses out on the playoff. I think he stays for his senior year. A lot of this conversation that we're having revolves around the offensive line as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So if he's taken care of, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you would feel a lot better about it.
If you take care of him and you can keep him standing up, I think he's more mobile than Grayson is too, so that's another thing. This kid has a swagger to him. Let him develop that swagger. Let him get that confidence.
That's Chris Mooneyham. That also is Sean Nerney. I'm Carlos Medina. We're out at the Smyrna Market Village for the second annual Tailgates and Touchdowns, brought to you by all of our sponsors, Bud Light, most notably Georgia's own credit union, Zaxby's, as well as Georgia's Natural Gas. All right, coming up next, this is going to be the nice part about it. Normally we have to keep all to college football, but this is the soft opening, so we can kind of do a little bit more here. We're going to talk a little bit of Falcons football. Fans, there's some optimism heading into the season.
Well said.
But one local team is feeling the opposite from their college football counterparts. We'll talk about that next right here on 680 The Fan. Soft opening of College Game Day. Soft opening of 680 College Game Day. That'll really get cranking next Saturday. We're going to be out at the Whitehall Tavern over right off of Peachtree. But today, we're out at the second annual Tailgates and Touchdowns in Smyrna Market Village, brought to you by Bud Light, Georgia's own, as well as Zaxby's. A lot of good sponsors. We're going to have live music getting going here in about 45 minutes. And we'll have our headliner a little later in the evening, Bubba Sparks. He's a big fan of the station. I'm a big fan of his work. Can't wait to actually, hopefully I'll get a chance to meet him, introduce myself, and say, hey, glad you finally got a chance to meet you after you being on the station a few times.
This is our scrimmage.
Oh,
or,
yeah.
Or our opening round non-conference. We're playing Alcorn State right now.
Yeah, this
so
is...
We're just getting rolling.
Like,
we
just broke fall camp.
Shells only.
Yeah.
We're not full pads.
Yeah, we're not full pads yet. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
This is full camp. You know what? By the end of this workout, we get to go jump in the pool because it's just not serious yet.
Yeah.
Well, like
no, and it's hot enough out here, and that was the first thing I noticed, other than the bouncy houses that we have that I'm going to sneak into before I get out of here. There is a fountain right in the middle of this square, and with the heat, there is also a good chance that you may see a large man swimming if you come and check us out.
You know what? What I would give, and this is where we got to figure this one out too, there's going to be a handful of opportunities when we're on the road where somebody at some establishment is going to ask you to partake in, hey, if you win this game, you got to come have shots with us.
Right.
And in the past, Brandon Adams, the 10 years ago, Brandon Adams would do it. The last year, 2 years ago, Brandon Adams won't do any of it. I'm willing to bet that if it's the right Tech fans – that happen to say, Nerney, come on over here, jump on
just
here
any
with
this. Tech fans and the right Tech fans.
then more than likely you'll be able to jump in and partake in some of these things.
Oh, I'm there.
So that's what we have going on. Also, we'll have the rest of the guys over from the station. Everybody's set to come in and start doing some roundtable discussions right around 4 o'clock. So hopefully we'll be able to get Finn to jump in over here. I know Steak's got some time that he's cut out. Kincaid's already out here. So you'll get a chance to meet everybody. We're all just going to be hanging out around the square and having a good time this evening. Though, coming up in about 10 minutes, Mooney's going to give us the realistic opportunities for a team that finishes second in their division to still make the playoffs. But right now, we got to talk about what's going on. Thursday night was a real bummer for the Atlanta Falcons. You want to talk about the dress rehearsal game and let's see the offense move. Sean, I think everything you surmised when we brought up the Falcons and you went, that was the perfect example of, I think, how a lot of Falcons fans felt after that ball game.
I mean, if that was the dress rehearsal for the season, then I don't want to show up for opening night. I mean, that was just – it was very sad to see. 3 points in the first half. You know, a couple things stood out to me. We're going to get to Matt Ryan in a second. Vic Beasley, you know, I keep waiting to see this guy, you know, turn it on and be able to win a one-on-one matchup. But, you know, I brought it up the other day, and I put it like this. It's almost as if he's wearing a Velcro suit. And as soon as he makes contact with that offensive tackle, they're just stuck. And he cannot roll off, cannot get away. And we kind of saw that throughout the game. Did not see much of him. Did not see him beat any one-on-ones. Also, Matt Ryan. We thought this year we would get over the red zone, you know, turnovers. A couple drives we had on Thursday, where we had some movement, got down the field, but we got an unfortunate situation once again where Matt Ryan throws into coverage, stares down Jacob Tammy, and throws a red zone turnover.
For all the fans that were frustrated talking about it, we will take your calls at 404-231-1680. If you looked at it and said, this looks a lot like last year, I think that was the frustration. Mooney has some numbers for you because of what went on Thursday, where you start to say, okay, what did it look like, just to remind myself, in 2015, because it's something you definitely want to avoid.
Yeah, if you have shots ready, as we were talking about shots earlier, you might want to take one
as I
start to rattle off these names, because we're going to revisit the 2015 season here really quick. Here's some names, some horrible, horrible names from 2015 you may remember. Kiko Alonso, David Bass, Avery Williamson, Quan Alexander, DeQuell Jackson, Lavonte David.
These all sound like linebackers.
Luke Kuechly, Paul Posluszny. Now, what do all those guys have in common? They all were able to, pick off Matt Ryan last year. As we know, a lot of those were right to said gentleman. 16 interceptions for Matt Ryan last year. You and I, we worked the Red Zone show.
Yep.
Football season, so, on Sundays, 1-7 here on 680 The Fan, 93.7.
So we saw pretty much all of them.
Right, and we talked about this extensively on the air, and at about the mid-season mark, I started to notice and commented to home team and to you back in the studio, man alive, it looks like he cannot throw the ball across the middle. And a lot of these interceptions seem to be coming from linebackers. So I started to dive into the numbers and watch it as it developed throughout the year. Again, 16 interceptions, half of which were taken away or given to linebackers. 11 of said 16 interceptions, guys, were either right on the hash mark, could have been deep, could have been short, or inside the hash mark. Now, what does that tell us? Well, it tells us a number of things. The bottom line is, I think, to answer the question that we're about to ask, has he regressed? Is it the offense? Is it both? I do. I think it's a combination of both. I think he has no confidence in this offense.
I think that we're at the point. Matt Ryan has done enough things in this town where you have to give him the benefit of the doubt that this is an offense that's not comfortable for you. There's a hope that, okay, after getting to run it for last year in an offseason within it, okay, this is how he's going to improve. But I think a lot of everything you just brought up, Mooney, points to the fact that when you ask certain guys to turn their back to the defense and then to quickly spin around and find your target and let's make the right kind of throw, if you haven't been doing that for most of your career, that is obviously a very big challenge. Nerney, you spend as much time around Finn. You know, there's things like that where I think people kind of take for granted when you ask a guy to make a change after playing where he has so long, it's very difficult
on him.
There's
definitely a mental hurdle you got to get to. And I think one of the things I've noticed is his footwork Thursday. He seemed to have happy feet, even when there was no pressure around him. He was chopping his feet, moving around that pocket, and specifically on that throw as well. And, you know, last year, obviously, they had big issues with the offensive line. Last couple seasons, they've had issues with the offensive line. So it's kind of understandable for him to have those happy feet. But even in the three games they played so far this preseason, the offensive line has played noticeably better than last year. So you kind of think if there's a mental hurdle, is he a little shell-shocked? And, you know, you mix that with learning a new system, and it's just not coming together.
Let's go on out to the phones. We will take your calls on what your expectations are. If that Thursday night kind of put a little bit of a damper into your Falcons' excitement, 404-231-1680. Let's go on out to Brian. Brian, you'll be the first caller up right here on the soft opening of 680 College Game Day. How you doing, Brian?
Doing good, guys. Yeah, I want to start with more pessimistic outlook, but also some optimism at the end of the phone call. But, you know, for me, this still goes back to Dimitrov's drafts the last two or three years that are just coming back to roost. It's the lack of talent on the team. And I think with up front, that is one of the main reasons why Matt Ryan's struggling. He's getting happy feet in the pocket. He just doesn't feel comfortable. I don't know if it's so much the plays. I just think it's the time he has to throw the football, who he has to throw the football to. We have no tight end now that's really a downfield threat. We'll see how the Hooper kid turns out. But for Matt Ryan, that's what I'm thinking is the negative of that. Now, for positives for me, I think the pass rush is not going to be any better. That's not a positive, but I think we've got ourselves a Pro Bowl potential defensive tackle in Grady Jarrett. I think he is going to be a star in this league. He is a solid player, and I really like the two linebackers as well, the rookies. And this is not a year where the Falcons are going to compete for a Super Bowl. For me, You put Warlow, Weatherspoon, whomever's the backups, and that's what they are. They're backups. You put the two rookies out there, trial by fire, let's get in there, get after it, and just develop a nasty attitude on defense, which is something I haven't seen in the last few years.
Well, thank you for the call, Brian. A lot of good points in there. And most definitely, if there is that silver lining, that happy place, it is Grady Jarrett. But the problem is that the worst place when you start talking about frustration level and you're assigning it to your quarterback, that is the most important position on the field and one that has the biggest factor on the field.
Yeah, I think the reason we can all have a very spirited debate about it is the obvious fact that there are so many things that go into it. One thing I'd like to point out, though, how come we don't see Matt throwing any more out routes?
Yeah.
Do they not have any built into the offense? Does Shanahan not like the out
route? The short out route, or are you talking about more of a corner?
Either.
Because I noticed a couple out routes, shorter out routes on Thursday,
and he
couldn't hit any of them. There was one, it was a third and one, I believe, and they were driving, one of the drives they had, and it was a third and one. I don't know if it was to Nick Williams, but just over his head. And even in the week one, he had one the same way to Julio Jones.
He was so good at that. Remember, yeah? Matt used to be so good at that. That was one of the staples of the old offense where – man, when it was third and four, we were picking up that first down on a 6-yard out route right on the sideline.
Yeah, Michael Jenkins, I remember one of Matt's first years, that 15-yard out route to Michael Jenkins, to I think against the Bears, to set up a
completely
field goal.
Disappeared. Yeah.
I think one of the things that we now downplay, and we don't realize how important it was, you had two of the guys in this league in Roddy White and Tony Gonzalez that were consistently catching 80 to 90 balls for first downs and over a couple year span. You're talking about guys that were chain movers, that the defense knew, okay, where is he? Because if it's third and seven, I got to make sure and watch this guy. Hey, it's third and five, we got to watch him. He's going to post us up and turn around and make a first down. That really doesn't seem so prevalent in this offense with this group of guys outside of Julio Jones. You don't have that guy on third and seven where you say he's going to get it, and that's just how it is.
And Tony Gonzalez was specifically on third and down over the middle. Tony Gonzalez was that guy where, you know, he could have had three guys on his back. Matt was going to get it to him, and Tony was going to post up, and he was going to get that ball. They don't have that right now. Tammy, while he's a solid receiving tight end, he's not a post-up tight end. He's a more crossing route, you know, get him in space and moving a little bit. And we'll see if Hooper, you know, he showed some promise, had a couple good receptions on Thursday. Unfortunate fumble. That's something that's a coachable moment. That's not going to, you know, hopefully that's not indicative of his career. But, you know, that tight end is another position that we're still trying to get back, the one we had Tony Gonzalez.
We'll go back on out to your phone calls, 404-231-1680, as we talk about your reactions to that Thursday game with the Falcons. Let's go on out to Greg. Greg, you joined 680 College Game Day, the soft opening, right here on 680 The Fan.
Yeah, been building over two or three years as a 50-some-odd year, 50-year Falcons fan. And I'll tell you what, I mean, just to hear these guys talk sounds like a PR firm. Sounds like that's the only thing that Blank is interested in is how people sound and how they're able to talk and spin things. And it's just a bunch of emptiness and a bunch of garbage that I think everybody can see through. No, I can't stand to hear any of them talk. Anybody that's got any kind of leadership or authority over what decisions that are made, those type of things. And I just think it goes all the way to the top with Blank's inability to to get really good football people in there and people who are just really going to be honest with themselves, with each other, and with the public, because it is just sounds like a hollow bunch of nothingness coming out of those people, and I don't even know if they even know what to do or what they're doing.
Well, Greg, I appreciate the call, and I'll tell you, part of it is this. You know the Falcons are looking to sell a product to you. They're looking to sell PSLs to you. They got to get you in the building. You know, when you sound a certain way, when your general manager sounds a certain way, it doesn't matter how he sounds as long as he's consistently drafting good talent, bringing good talent. It doesn't matter how your head coach sounds as long as you're winning ball games. I think that is that kind of that dangerous area they're in right now where a perception is we're not getting better. So even though you sound like everybody else around the league sounds, I'm getting frustrated with it.
Yeah, yeah. And let's if you boil this down to common sense, and let's forget that we have so much emotion built into it, really, what do you expect him to say? I mean, we haven't started the season yet. As the season was ending last year, and it was obvious we were not going to be a playoff team, I think that dike of his confidence, maybe it didn't break. Maybe
this
it didn't
being
chip.
Dan Quinn.
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah. Dan Quinn. Thank you. Yeah. Yes, I had it in my head. I didn't say it out loud, did I? No, I appreciate that. But he started to admit a little bit more towards the end of the year, well, this wasn't what we wanted to see. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. And it wasn't quite the same company line of Jacked and Ball and all this other all the other things he's been feeding us. He's got to sell the product before the season starts. He's got to be hopeful that this thing will come together, because if he starts to shift the narrative himself, already Arthur Blank is watching him. We all know that. And if he starts to shift the narrative himself, well, then he's going to be in trouble.
Yeah, and each coach has their own style of doing things, of dealing with the media. I mean, Bill Belichick, if you have a bad game, Bill Belichick may tear you apart during press conference. That's not Dan Quinn's style. He's more of the rah-rah, cliche-ish, which he goes great with Matt Ryan.
And if you're winning, everyone's like, that's fine, no problem.
Yeah, yeah. And he does, I would say, my only knock on Dan Quinn is sometimes he comes across as a little bit more high school coach-like, you know, build your players up, you know, no matter what they do, they, you know. Whereas sometimes fans, when they see a poor product on the field, they want to see the players get taken down a notch or two by the coach.
And I think that's always going to be one of the challenges is that, you know, the only thing that I've ever thought that's important for coaches, important for people in management, ownership, anything else, just be the same guy every day. Because then I know what my level of expectation has to be. If you're the tyrant one day and then you're my best friend the next day, that sends so many different signals that you don't get it. That's why so many of these coaches who've had success, long-term success in the NFL. First off, the NFL's not based on you getting long-term success. You know, I'm a big rah-rah guy. I'm Jim Harbaugh, and I took this team, and then I lost that team in San Francisco because eventually I just started to grade on guys. The guys that have these long careers are the ones that are just the same dude every single
day. Even keel,
here's what it is. You can be successful if you're Dan Quinn as long as you're winning and you're that rah-rah guy. Pete Carroll's been that rah-rah guy, but he consistently wins, so it actually works out for him.
I actually think Dan Quinn would be loved in this town if they were winning because he fits exactly what most Atlanta personalities are.
We're optimistic.
Right, right.
Yeah,
and not high-level flavor of you know, just bombastic and all of that. He would actually probably fit in very, very well if the team was winning.
Let's go. Let's go back on out to the phones, 404-231-1680. Take a couple more calls before we finish up this segment. Sideline Mike. Mike, you join us right here on 680, the Fans College Game Day.
You know what, man? I am so happy that we are doing this time of day on Saturday. I am giddy. But I will say this. When Arthur Blank interviewed Thomas Dimitroff on, what is it, go to meeting or whatever he did, and he did not interview anybody from the Pittsburgh Steelers organization, from the Baltimore Ravens organization, from the Green Bay Packers organization. The people who know how to let folks go when it's time to go and know how to find those gems in the third, fourth, and fifth round. When he didn't talk to any of those people, and you heard me say when he had that doggone scarf on, talking about it. All this other stuff.
Well, appreciate
at the end of the day, get that roof fixed on that stadium and get Wayne Rooney to come play here. The Falcons are on the apple sauce. He's too small. Everybody knows the draft is a 20% crapshoot anyway. You got the wrong guy. End of the day.
I appreciate the call, Mike. You're breaking up there a little bit. Appreciate the call, though. And yeah, I mean, here's the thing. We got to remember, this was back in 2007, 2008. When it looked like Bill Parcells was wrapped and done. He was going to Atlanta. He was going to lead the front office. And then suddenly when that fell apart and he took Wayne Huizenga's money to go to Miami, suddenly you did have the Falcons in kind of a scramble mode. I think we are downplaying the fact that Thomas Dimitroff has had success here as a talent evaluator, as a guy who's been able to draft talent. It's just that in the most recent years, you haven't seen him be able to stack draft classes on top of one another and continue the success that we saw in 2008, 2009, into 2010 either.
Yeah, and most of his misses have been in places where you can't miss.
Yeah.
You can't miss at center. You can't pick your first pick of the, you know, whatever draft it was to get Peter Kahns. You can't miss on a guy that's going to be your starting center. Lamar Holmes, miss. Your interior peer, Parade Jerry. Your frontline guys, you have got to replenish those guys as you move along. And that's something that Dimitroff, and I will say this, we brought up Grady Jarrett earlier, and a little plug, I did write an article on the 680 Fan Ultimate Football Guide that's just came out on Grady Jarrett being the 2016 breakthrough player for the Falcons, and I thoroughly believe that. The motor you see on this guy, he was one of the bright spots Thursday night when you saw him, and he was a fifth round pick, and if he continues, he will be that late round gem that Thomas Dimitroff, to his credit, drafted.
A few little pieces here on a few things that have been brought up. First of all, Bill Belichick was drafting players in New England.
Yeah.
Not the front office.
It was a combination group, yeah. But it was all ultimately he got to make the choice.
If we all go back and we do remember, the caller has a point. There was not a lot of interviewing that was going on from Arthur Blank. He did not take the tour of the top franchises across the National Football League. So I think it was Sideline Mike. Mike, dead on, my friend. Now, who is the greatest defensive – who's the best defensive draft pick that Thomas Dimitroff has ever had?
Ooh.
You know, I if you remember, Los, I asked this question a lot last year with home team, who's here at the Smyrna Market Village, by the way. Come join us for tailgates and touchdowns. Right here to my right, Chuck Oliver, John Kincaid.
I think I would lean towards one of two, and here's the crazy part.
Right.
I would lean towards Trufant, but you also have to say something about Croy Bierman playing as long as he has and being productive under what role they asked him as a fifth-rounder.
Just real quick, Nerney.
I got to say, I was leaning the same way towards Trufant, and I'm thinking it may morph into Grady Jarrett as we go down the road.
Now think about the names we just mentioned.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to let the dead air sit there.
Tells you what you need
to know. Really, though, seriously, and that's the thing. You're right. He's done well in rounds, besides certain guys in round one and two, the offensive line. But he's done well in one and two, but man, three and four and five, where you're finding guys that are going to help you win a Super Bowl, he's been porous.
And that's the thing. When you are hitting on rounds four, five, and six, that keeps you cheap. That keeps you from having to spend $3 million on a kicker or $3 million on a return man. That is that area where teams that are really good in this league find a way. If you get a guy, if you get Campbell to play linebacker here for 4 years and he's productive and he plays for you, you're sitting back going, I just hit a home run with that pick. Okay, you know what happens 4 years down the road? Who's my next one? Because you have to keep stacking those usable three and four and fifth round picks on top of one another. That's how you end up really beating this thing.
And one other thing that chimes into the New England connection. I ran the stat last year when we were doing a lot of the fill-in holiday work. New England, if you go back and look at it, had 4 out of 5 years where they had at least 10 picks.
That's the thing. Yeah.
Had at least 10 picks in 4 out of 5 years.
They're known to trade down. I mean, trading down is their
exactly
forte.
Right.
But what a lot of people forget this. The big factor in draft success, it's not that you hit home runs all the time, because no one does that. I think about the 90s Dallas Cowboys, and the reason why, for people like Jimmy Johnson was a great Italian evaluator, they drafted this many Hall of Famers, they did this and this.
Quantity.
They had more picks than everybody.
Right.
He's only hitting on about 35%, but when you're picking 15 players, that 35% turns into an extra two or three players every single draft year. That's that New England philosophy that overall the numbers show you the more draft picks you have, the better off your draft classes are going
to
be.
And you don't have to hit, like you said, you don't have to hit home runs. You don't have to draft these guys that are going to be starters for 4 years, the entirety of their contract. But the guys you draft, they need to contribute in some fashion, whether it be special teams. I mean, a lot of these guys, I mean, Parade Jerry, gone. Cons, completely gone. Yeah. They didn't contribute whatsoever.
It's like people bagging on the recruiting star system.
Yeah.
At Scout, Rivals, 24/7, those services. Of course some of these kids are getting 4 stars, and they're not going to be 4 stars when they get on the Georgia campus, the Alabama campus. But the plain and simple fact is, if you're getting more 4 stars than everybody else, your chances just went up exponentially of landing 10 guys that are going to be a contributor.
Well, we appreciate your calls on that topic. We're going to finish off this segment by talking a little bit of some college football. And here's the thing. Mooney has this idea, and I want to hear about it because
You think I'm crazy?
Well, no, I've thought about it from this standpoint. I have argued for the better part of 2 years with the college football playoff system that the way it is, this could never happen. But when you talk about the parity around college football, that if you have that random year where, all right, this team clearly is one of the top four in the country, right, but they were not at this level, they could still get in. You're talking about somebody who second place in their division, yet could still make the
playoffs.
That's
why you and I get along, because I've been having the same conversation.
We're cycle sisters, yes.
Right,
yes.
I start tomorrow, by the way.
Okay, I'll be there tomorrow, too.
This could be the year. I mean, this could be the year that it happens. And my only thought, this is where it starts. We know how good LSU is going to be. Is it conceivable their only loss this year is to Alabama?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And we know that they would have beaten Ole Miss. I forgot to include Ole Miss in our prep work that I meant to send you, by the way. Same situation could be said for Ole Miss. If their defense is good enough, we know their offense is going to be good. What if they only lose to Alabama and they beat LSU and they run the table in the rest of the SEC West? What if FSU's only loss is to Clemson?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, FSU's got a sneaky good schedule this year. It's not great, but it's sneaky good. And the rating could be higher once you take in the totality of said schedule. I just think that, first of all, let's tick some guys off. And I don't want to get too long-winded into this. You can all go out there and check out the schedules in your magazines or your dot-coms or whatever. So I'm going to blow through this and not get too long-winded, but here's my thing. Look at the first four games that Stanford plays. Host Kansas State, host USC, at UCLA, and at Washington. Now, Washington is what
it is. They're growing. They're improving.
They're improving.
There's
no doubt about
it.
Right. Yeah. They could go 2-2 there. And don't forget, they have Notre Dame coming up mid-October sometime. I forget the exact date. Okay, Stanford's still, in my mind, going to win the Pac-12, despite two losses. Anybody agree or disagree hard?
Perfectly possible.
Okay.
Perfectly
Ernie?
Possible.
No,
cool.
Absolutely. I'm
okay.
Right there.
All right. Now, Iowa, going to lose a game, maybe two. They're going to be good this year in the Big Ten. But their schedule, a whole lot softer than, say, Michigan State, Michigan, and Ohio State. The three of them all play each other this year, and I got a sneaking suspicion they're going to beat up on each other this year. Michigan feels very confident, even though they're the lesser of the three teams this year, that they can beat either one of those teams.
They have a very soft schedule, even in comparison to those two.
Exactly right. So I think you're going to have a war of attrition in the Big Ten. Now, what about the Big 12, you say? Well, that could be the fly in my ointment, because I do think that Oklahoma could be just a one-loss team. And if they're one-loss and a conference champion, obviously they would make it in over at least one of these second-place teams. How about Houston? Well, they've got Oklahoma early, and I think Oklahoma beats Houston early while they're still trying to figure out some of their running back questions and their defensive questions. I'm just saying, I'm not hardcore on this prediction. I do love giving predictions, and this is not one that I'm hardcore about, but I do think absolutely that one of these teams of the three will be in the running, not two, but one of LSU, FSU, and Ole Miss could make their way to the number four seed in the college football playoff.
I don't even care about the teams involved so much. I don't even care about the conference so much, because here's the idea that the college football playoff system in part was put together to make sure that we don't end up with another LSU-Alabama. That's one of the things that they didn't want to talk about, but that's part of one of the big things. They didn't want same conference playing each other for a national championship. That's why there's the criteria within their weighting system of championships won will carry more weight than everything else. But that is where it's ultimately going to be a test, because if I'm a two- or three-loss champion,
right,
if it happens to be one of those games where you say Stanford, hey, let's say Stanford slips up somewhere yet still wins it, they're a three-loss team. Yet one of those other teams, whether it's FSU, whether it's Clemson, whether it's LSU, I don't even care who the other team is, conference champion from the ACC, conference champion from the SEC, and one additional school from either conference with one loss and clearly one of the best four teams, that's going to be the giant test of this whole thing.
Right. That's what I think we're looking at, honest to goodness. And I've got LSU pegged as the team that plays out this potential scenario for me. I have Alabama winning the SEC, number one. I think they're going to run the table at number one this year, by the way. Clemson, that's not counting the playoff.
Yeah.
Clemson is the number two, undefeated. But I'm telling you something. LSU, with Fournette, a good defense, Harris will be good enough. I think they could absolutely only lose to Alabama in a slugfest in the regular season, potentially finish second in that division, and get to that number four seed. I know they want conference champions, but they're going to have a lot of people to answer to. If Stanford loses two games, even if they're early in the year, if Stanford starts 2-2, which I think they could, if Stanford starts 2-2 and wins out, you're still going to be hard-pressed to convince a lot of people. If I told you right now LSU's one loss, only Alabama, by 3 points at the end, Stanford lost twice. Yeah, they got a seven-game winning streak, and they won the Pac-12. Who are you going
to
pick?
That's where the danger comes in, where you have to pay attention to what's going on in the Big 12 and how good is Notre Dame, because those are always going to be the flies in the ointment this year if we're seeing as good good of teams in the ACC and the SEC as we believe that we are. All right, coming up next, Kirby Smart isn't going to tell us who the starting quarterback will be until he decides that it's time to, but he may have tipped his hand just a little bit this week. We will tell you about that next. It's Mooney, it's Nerney, it's Los out here at the second annual Tailgates and Touchdowns right here on 680 The Fan.